Dr. Janet Jacob Erickson, who is a researcher specializing in maternal well-being and the influence of non-maternal childcare on children's development. She completed a PhD in family social science from the University of Minnesota in 2007, following which she became an assistant professor in the School of Family Life at Brigham Young University. During her graduate work, she completed a social science fellowship at the Heritage Foundation in Washington, D.C., where she helped provide research analyses on non-maternal care to policymakers. She is married to Michael Erickson, and they are the proud parents of one daughter. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Erickson.
Thank you, and sorry that you've been hearing us all day. But we have a little one who doesn't like to crawl, but she loves to talk, as you could tell. It's a pleasure to be here. And Michael and I, as we were talking about interacting with you, both of us just mentioned how impressed we are with you as students. And as I start, I want you to know that you make a difference. Sometimes it can feel like it's overwhelmingly the other view that's pervasive around you. I once heard a professor that I worked with closely at the University of Minnesota talk about cultural change. And he said, Janet, every time a person does anything, it's carried 20 by 20 times out there. The comments that you make, the way that you live, making a comment to someone that would invite them to think differently about cohabitation, choosing to live a virtuous life yourself, and demonstrating that, all of those things are powerful influences, far more than you recognize. And you really are the key to cultural change. We depend on you. The future depends on what you offer and what you study and what you care about. The other thing is, I want to tell you just a little bit about my life as I start on this question of, does having a mother really matter? I am one of 11 children. I'm the fifth, and I have 8 sisters. So I have grown up with many women and talked a great deal about issues surrounding motherhood and womanhood. I completed my PhD, and I was working as an assistant professor for a couple of years before I met my husband, Mike. We were both 34 when we met. There's hope for all kinds of people out there. And he grew up in a family where his family experienced divorce, and I grew up in a big, intact kind of family. And it's been just a great experience to be together and to see different perspectives. And so those of you who come from families where you might feel like, boy, I didn't have, and you know all of us are broken in some way, right? That's just the nature of being mortal. That those of you who might feel like, gosh, I'm pretty broken, I want you to know that there's a lot of great hope, and that your interest in these issues and your efforts to help others are really important, and they make a big difference. And so after working for a couple of years as assistant professor and getting married to Michael, we were able to have our first child, and I had those questions of work and family. I studied work and family. I did quite a bit of research on work and family. I knew what it was like for mothers, and I want to tell you what a joy it has been to be home full-time with our daughter. And I am so grateful for the opportunity that is to be home with her. And those of you who wonder what you'll do, it is so busy. I thought as a single person I was incredibly busy. Life is busy as a single person trying to do school. And then it just seems to get busier. And then as a mother, you figure out how to multitask at levels you never realized were possible before. And I find that having had an education and opportunities before marriage has only strengthen and enhance the opportunities after being a mother and being at home. There are so many different ways to contribute that you will find. And so those are just thoughts about that. Now, having said that, I have a sister who is recently divorced. She's a mother of 6 children, and she has had to go back to work. And sometimes we find ourselves in that situation as well, in that difficult situation. And I'll refer to her as I talk about the consequences of non-maternal care in this discussion, and hopefully give hope to those of us that experience those kind of dynamics as well. So here's this title, the question we never thought we'd ask. And the reason that I say that is because I think generations past could never have imagined we would actually question whether it mattered to have your mother care for you. Because, of course, one of the great tragedies in the past, one of the most important tragedies that could happen in a child's life would be to lose a parent, and particularly to lose a mother. But in a recent study in our premier journal in the School of Family Life, there's a journal called the Journal of Marriage and Family, February of 2010, there was a study released, and this is what it said. It said, we are in the process of deconstructing the essential father-mother, meaning whether or not, in fact, fathers and mothers are essential. And then the second point was, Researchers agree that men and women parent differently, but do not agree on the sources. You've heard about biological sources. You've heard about socialization sources. We don't agree on the sources, the fixity, how fixed those differences are, or the consequences of those differences. So this study, this journal article, was going to make this conclusion, and this is what they concluded. Two compatible parents provide advantages for children over single parents. So in other words, two is better than one. But then it followed with, irrespective of gender, doesn't matter that it's a woman or a man, marital status, doesn't matter that they're married, sexual identity, which was a given in this particular article, or biogenetic status, whether or not they are biologically connected to those children. And this was their conclusion. We'll come back to this same study at the end of this discussion and what they were drawing on in making those conclusions. But it's had a loud influence in our area of study, because the assumption has been it doesn't matter if they're biologically connected, and it doesn't matter if it's a woman or a man. So we just go back a little ways, go back to the mid-1900s, and we get this scholar in England named John Bowlby. Many of you have heard of him, because in every child development class, you're going to study him. He was a scholar of attachment, and he was working as a psychologist with thieves, if you will, people who were incarcerated. And one of the things that he noticed was that every one of these thieves had at one period in their lives been deprived of their own maternal care. Their mother was absent. Either she died, they were hospitalized for an extensive period of time, and she couldn't be with them. And he started to get these notions about the importance of this mother figure in the lives of people in terms of their psychopathological development. And he said, children deprived of maternal care during extended periods, it could be a couple of years or more, lacked feeling, had superficial relationships, and exhibited hostile or antisocial tendencies. This led to what we call attachment research. And he was kind of our first theorist about that there seems to be something unique about this biological mother and her ability to attach in unique ways to this child, and that she was biologically predisposed to it. Now, this is before they could test oxytocin and other hormones in the body. But he was at that level. He was recognizing there's something biological in her that seems to make her able to connect in a unique way with this child, and that connection is critical for that child's psychological development. So what went on is a woman joined his research team, Mary Ainsworth. She studied all over the world, focused her work in Africa, and she looked at how mothers interacted with their babies. And she came up with this idea. She said, it's not just the fact that the mother interacts, but it's how she interacts that's so critical. And she called it maternal sensitivity. Now, sometimes when I use that word, it's hard to understand. Well, what does it mean to have maternal sensitivity? So here's a way to look at it. It's a mother's ability to detect, interpret, respond to needs, and to be positive, kind in her interactions, and also respect the autonomy of that child. Now, I studied this for a long time before becoming a mother, but it is fascinating as a mother to experience these thoughts and feelings. So I'll hear her cry, right? You've heard of this whole horse whisperer, cry whisperer thing. Try to understand what is it that she's trying to express, knowing that I need to respond to this cry. That's one of those key things, to detect it, to respond to it, and then make an effort to interpret it, to be positive in those interactions, and then this very interesting one of respecting autonomy. So you've got to let them crawl, right, out, and you've also got to make sure they're safe and protect them that way, and not be pushy in how you're controlling their behaviors, but also protective. What we found out is this continued maternal sensitivity, not just when a baby's an infant, but even through adolescence, we can measure a mother's ability to do these things still, that it's critical to that child's psychological, in particular, development. It's like a protecting blanket, in a sense. Now, this is what I think is fascinating. Now we have the capacity to observe a baby's brain. We can watch on camera what's happening in the development of that brain. And people have been able to observe, Alan Shore here, who cited 1994 publication, you can observe a baby's brain, the synapses kind of connect, and the formation of this right hemisphere while the mother's interacting. And he would say this, maternal sensitivity in interactions leads to the development and functioning of certain cerebral regions. In other words, it's core to that brain development. Mothers sensitively modify their stimulation to the infant. And people would say, people who study this would say, mothers are remarkably adept at this. They know when it's too much. They know when there's going to be too much stimulation for that infant, and they'll hold back. They know when there's not enough, and they'll modify so that it's just the right amount of stimulation for the brain to develop. Do you think women are aware of this when they're doing it? No. That's the most remarkable thing about it. You don't even know you're doing it. It's just, and that's what Bowlby would say, it's like it's innate. Especially if you've been shown that yourself growing up. Through fine-tuned inputs, she is able to match and synchronize to her infant state, appropriately providing the optimal chunked bits of stimulation needed for the child's developing right hemisphere, doing it just perfectly. So this is the NICHD, the National Institute for Child Health and Human Development. This is their most recent conclusion about the importance of maternal sensitivity. It is the strongest, most consistent predictor of a child's cognitive, so their brain functioning, how they do with conceptual things, their social interactions, how they see other people and relate to other people, and their emotional development, whether or not they withdraw or they're aggressive in their behaviors. It is the strongest and most consistent predictor. Now, I'll come back to this as we talk through non-maternal childcare. So this led to questions, right? We knew about Bowlby's studies of attachment. We knew mothers mattered a lot. We could watch brain development. And so in the early 1990s, the United States funded a big study on non-maternal care. And the attempt of this study was to just really answer this question once and for all. Does it hurt children to be away from their mothers for extensive period of time in daycare? And you can imagine there were feelings all over the place about this, right? That it didn't matter, that it did. They wanted to really get at this and find out what it was that did matter. And when they looked at the findings, and you can imagine they're tracking these children. I always wonder, what would it have been like to be in this study? Because they'd come every 3 months, observe you as a mother interacting with your child, observe the father if there was a father present. They'd go to the daycare center. They'd observe all the interactions there. They'd do all kinds of surveys. It was really extensive. They did not want to leave any question unanswered. And when the children were 2 years old, it didn't look like there was hardly anything that was problematic about having children away from their mothers for an extensive period of time. In other words, daycare didn't hurt. So what do you think the media reported? Right? Women, you can allay your fears, not a big deal. Your children are doing fine. They're thriving. We know maternal sensitivity matters. This issue of time doesn't seem to matter. And we went along. Then at 4.5, they did another one. And this time, all of a sudden, there were all these findings that showed concern about this. What they found is that between age 4 to 5, where children had been in extensive non-maternal care, 30 hours a week on average, they had less social competence and cooperation, more problem behaviors, negative mood, aggression, and conflict, and that the effective hours spent there prior to kindergarten were comparable to the effect of poverty. You know that in the policy world, what do we get really concerned about? People growing up in poverty, because it's very devastating. And what they found out was this was similar in terms of its effect size. Now, these are educated mothers. These are capable mothers. These are not low-income people. Their children are in daycare, and the effects of daycare were similar to what would have been the effects of poverty. And so there was concern about this. What's interesting is they've been following these children. Now they're 15 years old, these children are. And in third grade, they found out that these children had fewer social skills still. And then they had this other measure, poor work habits. It was harder to concentrate on school. It was harder to follow through with schoolwork things. Then in the sixth grade, they saw problem behaviors, but they were associated only significantly with center care. Children who had spent a lot of time in daycare centers. So that would mean, well, if they were with the neighbor in the local neighborhood or they were with grandma, it didn't seem to have the same negative effects that persisted, at least. So just recently, age 15, those measures in 2010, they released a study, and they weren't looking at the same things because 15-year-olds are experiencing different things. What they found out is 15-year-olds reported more risk-taking behaviors. Like, what would that be? That's things like drugs and alcohol and dangerous kinds of behaviors. and impulsivity, meaning they felt like they were less in control of their behaviors. Things were just acted out of impulse. Now, some of you grew up in daycare. My husband's one of those. He was in daycare a lot of hours. And so when I present these findings, I don't want you to feel like you're going to meet somebody and just be like, well, no wonder you're in prison, you know? But because, and I think that's why this is this other finding is really important, is that the way the mother interacts with that baby when she is with that baby is still the single most important factor. And so what we need to do when we can't control the factors of who's caring for that baby all the time is look for ways to strengthen her ability to be sensitive as a mother. And that's where fathers play another key role, and marriage plays another key role. Other key findings. So people said, well, what about if it being high quality daycare? We're talking about low quality stuff, right? What about high quality? And what they found is there's some positive effects. Even when they're 15, they could see some positive effects, but it was not nearly what anybody in the NICHD study expected. Quality just didn't show up. It doesn't seem to have the same impact. And then this third one that I think is even more important than it has been highlighted in the media especially, that as mothers are away from their children for a long period of time, what do you think happens to her knowledge and awareness of that child? And so that seems to predict a decrease in sensitivity for her. Now, when we look at sensitivity, we're looking at how the baby interacts with the mother as well as how the mother interacts with the baby. And so it might be that the child feels more distant from the mother, so they're interacting less sensitively in that interaction. But something goes on when the time isn't the same that affects her ability to sensitively interact. Okay, so I want you to keep that in your head, the power of mothers. And then I'm going to move to other stuff. So the big question recently has been, if gender doesn't matter, then can men do this thing? Can men be like mothers in this? If we think that mothering is really important, but we're also arguing that gender doesn't matter, it doesn't matter if it's a woman or a man, then we're going to assume that fathers can mother in this way, right? And so recently a study released in 2007, it's one of the best, I think, on this issue. She interviewed 118 fathers who identified themselves as primary caregivers. Some of them were widowed. Some of them were divorced. But many of them were stay-at-home dads. And they had chosen to be the primary caregiver while the wife went out and earned the living for the family. And she did a lot of work with them to find out, do they do it like mothers do it? So she talked to these fathers a lot. And interestingly enough, you might expect this, but all these fathers would say things like this. Moms are more protective. They're more nurturing. They acknowledge this difference. And they said, she's different than I am in the way that she nurtures. Here's a couple of quotes. I think it's a spiritual thing. They were with their mom before they came to earth, meaning in the womb, this mother was connected to this baby. That's what men do not have, that extra, extra special thing with children. These are men who are with their children full time. These are these full time father caregivers. And they're still acknowledging there's something about this mother relationship that I don't have in the same way. Mothers influence the processes of fathers becoming and enacting their caregiving. So this is what David Blankenhorn was talking about. Women have a strong influence on how the father fathers. And his relationship with her is key to that interaction, fathers with children. Fathers themselves recognize that. And so one of them said, you have to recognize that even as a stay-at-home father, you can never replace the mother. Don't even think about it. It's impossible. Here's another one. They would recognize that there was this something about birthing. There was something about this process of birthing a child. There was something about the hormones that happen. It's not the same. She holds the baby more to her body. She rocks the baby more. I love her and everything, but I don't hug her as much. She's not part of me as much. And we know from attachment that a baby doesn't distinguish themselves from their mother for a long time, a year and a half. We don't know exactly when it happens, but they see themselves as connected to that mother. I was there at the birth. This is another father talking. I was there for all three of them, and I had a connection with them, but she had her body transformed. And anyone that's had a baby knows that's exactly what happens. You conceive a child. You watch your baby, your body be transformed. You have a child, and your body's transformed. I don't think we can undermine the fact that women are connected to their children in that very physical, that very primordial sense. In my opinion, women have an edge in parenting. This is fathers who are stay-at-home fathers saying, she's got an edge in this thing. Whether you say psychological or hormonal or whatever. So that leads to the question, so then what do fathers do? And I'm going to add to what's already been shared about what fathers contribute, because this dialogue of what fathers do is the key piece in understanding what fathers and mothers do differently, if you will. We have got to understand what fathers do. And I'm going to make the argument that we have not been able to measure this very well. So as I share why sort of key things about what fathers do versus mothers, I want you to be thinking as researchers, going back to your universities, why is this hard to measure? Why is it hard to get at what fathers are contributing uniquely to children? And my husband and I, he's an only child, so I'm one of 11, he's an only child. He never watched anybody care for children. But within, and I watched lots of that, of course, within just a few minutes of having our baby, I was cooing with this baby, and he was tossing her. It was unbelievable. And I didn't even read this particular language until she was 6 months old, and I said, Mike, can you believe it? Here we are. Here you were doing all this tossing, and I was automatically wanting to coo with her and talk to her and interact in that way. So I want you to be thinking about these five things. I think they're amazing. Number one, fathers use play to connect. They connect with their children as well, but they connect in a way that's playful, while mothers will coo, talk, cuddle, touch that way. Second one, this is a father saying this. I get them out as much as possible. One of the things she found out is these fathers would spend a lot of time with their children outside, and they thought about it. They've got to be outside. They wanted them to be experiencing the outside world. They wanted them to figure out how to interface with the outside world. Mothers weren't as natural in thinking about that. And so physical exertion, like he talked about, climbing up to the top of things, that was really important for fathers to do. I like this third one, where, and you've already heard a little bit about this today also, where her response when there was an injury, or the child comes home from school and says this friend was mean to her. What do you think the mother does? She's all about in the moment, comforting, understanding the feelings of that child. The dad, he's all about fixing it. I got to fix this problem. And so he'll talk about the problem solving related to that issue before he will talk about the feelings solving there, where the mother will do that differently. And so fathers would call this strategic indifference. I'm playing indifference for the purpose of helping foster problem solving around this issue. Here's the next one. I'm willing to let these kids fail. Father or mother saying that. Yes, father's really big into this risk-taking. I want you to be able to face things. And so it might require some failure. And that mother, I know how I am. Failure, right? Protect them at all costs. That we don't want them to fail in any way. So you want to set up the situation so that they won't fail. Where that father says, no, they've got to risk it because there will be failure in the future. They've got to face that now. The last one, this dad would say as he was being interviewed, I tell my kids they can make their own lunches. You guys can make your own lunches. And her first response, I'll just show you in her quote after that, as she's hearing these fathers talk about this, is there's another sign, father's pulling out of fathering, right? They're wanting to just pull out of it and let their kids do it on their own, where a mother would be like, I got to be there making sure it's this and this healthy and this kind of lunch. They're pulling out. But instead, what she could see is this father's all about promoting their independence. And not just physical independence, but their intellectual independence, asking certain questions to get them to think independently and emotionally independently. And so her question was, as she looked at these things, are fathers offering protective care, the kind we think is important for children's development, or are they offering its opposite? Are they really pulling out? And here's her quote. My first interpretation was that this was an evidence of the father letting go of his child, in contrast to dominant understandings of nurturing and protective care that suggests that the parent is connected to or holds on to the child. In other words, we have defined nurturing in one dimension in the science, and that is that it's always evidenced in holding on to that child, in protecting the child. So she follows it up with this. Gradually, however, I came to view this behavior as an integral part of nurturing. That is, the protective care of children with its qualities of attentiveness, responsiveness, and competence involves just what you were saying, David Blankenhorn, involves both holding on and letting go. And it is the careful letting go that fathers demonstrate particularly well, and mothers don't, she could have said. Mothers don't. So this was her conclusion to this question of do men mother. She says, I'm going to come back to the first bullet after I talk about the last two. Fathers experience profound moral transformations in caring for children. We know mothers do, by the way. We know mothers are put on a trajectory of selflessness and giving as soon as they have a baby. That's a pretty strong trajectory. When fathers care for children, they also experience a transformation. She described it as hard edges are softened. They recognize the value in caring work like dishes and wiping noses and diaper changing. They articulate a commitment to taking on women's work. But then here was her conclusion after all this study. But these fathers are not mothering. And they are not mothers. They are reconfiguring fathering and masculinity. They are not becoming mothers in the process. The first bullet was kind of referred to earlier today when you heard about this strong pull that mothers have toward mothering, like all of you women commenting on our baby, right? Naturally, our eyes are drawn that way. That's biological. That's what Bowlby would say. That's as innate as anything. And not that men don't do that also, aren't drawn to children also, but it's different. But she would say this, what she found out when fathers were taking care of their children full time and the mothers were out in the workforce, it wasn't like they switched. We might think about it as kind of a switch. Well, she's now working, she looks like a father, and he's now at home, he looks like a mother. What she found out is that mothers still feel very pulled. And when they come home, they feel this strong pull towards mothering. And so they talk about it as shared caregiving. Women who are working full-time and have fathers that are stay at home, they'll talk about it as shared caregiving. They don't talk about it as a role reversal. And she would say that's because there's a profound pull to nurture those children that she feels, even if she's the primary breadwinner and is away a lot, she still feels like, I have got to be there. And so the way mothers would talk about it is they'd come home and they'd say, I'm there. I am fully there because I care about how these children are doing and I feel a pull towards this. Okay, so here's the study in 2010 by Bibi Larson Stacy that got all this hoopla about it because they said, look, the research shows it doesn't matter if it's a mother or father. It just matters if there's two parents. And this is what they decided to do. They decided they would compare studies that looked at single fathers versus single mothers to see do they parent differently. They'd look at differences between married wives and husbands. And they'd also look, in a smaller group of studies, they'd look at planned lesbian co-parent families, so two mothers, versus a heterosexual married parent family. Now, the studies do not show that the relationship between the children of the heterosexual couple was biological. They weren't necessarily looking at biology there, but maybe adoptive parents versus lesbian adoptive parents, okay? No studies of planned gay fathers included child outcomes. And therefore, we have, when people argue that it's the same, I want you to know, we have zero studies of motherless parenting. We have studies of fatherless parenting, the outcomes of that, of two lesbian women. We have zero studies that look at two fathers parenting and the outcomes of children there. And what they found out is, I like how one woman talked about this study. She said, their conclusion was women and men are equal, except women are better. They're just better. They're better parents in this whole thing. And really, essentially, though, the study argued that gender didn't matter. It was coming up with this idea that the ideal is to have two mothers because mothers are good at this nurturing thing. So they looked at female parents more than heterosexual men, and they found out that female parents, more than their husbands, were aware, they were concerned, they were problem-solving issues about schoolwork and things like that. They seemed to be more available. They showed more respect for their children's autonomy. There was warmth, affection, attachment, interaction. And so you get this high dose of what we'll look at as lots of middle-class feminine parenting. So we're looking at what mothers do, and we're showing a lot of it, particularly when you have two mothers versus a combination of a mother and a father. So when they looked at two mothers, they found there was more time in imaginative play and domestic play, more activities with children, less limit setting, disciplinary control, emphasis on social conformity. And the assumption is all these things are really good, clearly really good. that parenting at its best is a very feminine looking thing. It's a very protective kind of thing. It's a very nurturing thing. And so what you find out is fathers and what fathers offer are not even included in the measures as being valuable. Now, part of that might be because when we look at young children, there's a different dynamic going on between the father and mother and how they care for young children versus how children are when they are older. So this woman who did studies on stay-at-home fathers, Andrew Doucet, she would say, as she looks at how emotionally connected mothers are, she found out over time, children come to their fathers for other things than they go to their mothers. And fathers, so as they get older, they want to figure out, how do I negotiate this world that I live in? Dad, how do I get a job? How do I do a resume? How do I take care of this whole thing? And who do you think they go to? Dad. And that his emotional work there is something that fills a huge hole that that mother can't often give in the same way. And so this emotion work that a mother is doing when children are very young seems to look different as the children get older. And fathers and mothers take a different kind of, if you will, they fill in different parts of the pie in caring for children as they get older. Now, part of what we're seeing here is there are no measures for that kind of thing. There's no way to identify what are fathers uniquely contributing. So, of course, we're going to come up with a conclusion. If we're measuring parenting in terms of feminine, nurturing kinds of traits, we're going to come up with the thing that, well, two mothers are better than one, right? Because you're getting a double dose of this middle-class mothering going on. And then when we look at single mothers versus single fathers, this is their conclusion again. So mothers are better. Mothers spent more time with their children talking and participating in school-related events. They displayed more affection and warmth. They knew the names of their children's friends better than the fathers. They had more rule setting and supervision. They had less difficulty monitoring children's school progress and health habits and friends. They had lower rates of delinquency. The children did of these mothers and single fathers and high attachment security. Now, the big question comes up with this one. How did this mother end up being single versus how did the father end up being single? And it also highlights that fathers are more connected to their children when they are what? Married to the mother of those children. Fathers, that dynamic, that relationship between the wife and the husband has a lot to do with how he fathers. And so you're going to see differences when you look at single mothers versus single fathers in terms of these outcomes. Okay, so I already told you that one of the statements is, well, men and women are the same, but women are better at this parenting thing. Here's the quotes from that study. We do not yet have comparable research on children parented by two men. And I told you, are there any studies on that? There's zero studies, okay? But they said, but there are good reasons to anticipate similar strengths among male couples who choose parenthood. Now I have to ask, why? I've taken you through all the stuff that shows who's better. Women, right? Women are better at this parenting thing. And yet this is their concluding statement. We don't have comparable research to look at children parented by two men, but there's good reasons to anticipate similar strengths among male couples who choose parenthood. And they base that assumption on this idea that gay men parent in ways that are closer, they think, closer to lesbian women than to a heterosexual couple. And that conclusion is based on what they call more egalitarianism, meaning these two men will share caregiving more equally than a father and a mother who are heterosexual, right, where he's working and she's caring for that child, and that's supposed to be a bad thing. The assumption is that's a bad thing, this imbalance in the amount of time that children are spending with the mother and father. Two women parent better on average than a woman and a man, or at least than a woman and a man with the traditional division of household labor. So the assumption is it's the big problem is we've got this traditional division of household labor, and that's messing up family life. That's inherent to marriage, and so marriage is really a bad thing, and what we need are two lesbian mothers parenting children. I mean, that's essentially the take-home message. But you remember what I said first? The first statement really was, two compatible parents provide advantages for children over single parents, irrespective of gender. Even though their findings don't really show that. Their findings kind of show that mothers are really good at what they do. And yet we're concluding that gender doesn't really matter. Now I hope this study raises questions about how we measure what fathers do, first of all. And second of all, how we talk about the needs of children. I want to just share quickly a story that happened in Doucet's study of these stay-at-home fathers, and then I'll come back to some of the findings about mothers again. But she was the one studying those stay-at-home fathers and interviewing them and asking lots of questions. And one of her thoughts was, well, these men, it's really kind of pathetic because in the culture that they're in, they're seen as, you know, kind of dumb because they're stay-at-home dads and they don't have all these rights that people should have if they're caring for children. And we really ought to get out and advocate for stay-at-home fathers. And so she had these focus groups where she was trying to generate these questions about rights and to get our fathers to say, you're right. We got to switch this cultural value about motherhood and value stay-at-home dads for what they do. And so she's trying to get them to do this. And she describes how, as she's standing there doing that, she asks them this question. In an ideal world, what resources or supports would you like to see for single fathers? And she's waiting for, gosh, you know, some social support, some money maybe, whatever, some extra value. And this is what finally, it was quiet for a little while. She says, one man stood up, and he kind of spoke for the group, and he said this. An ideal world would be one with a father and a mother. Now, these are primary caregiving fathers, many of whom were single because of various reasons. And then he went on to say, we'd be lying if we pretended that wasn't true. How can there be an ideal world without a mother for the children? And it really quieted her. And her thought was, these men, they seem to believe that the world needs both. And that even though they are doing the best that they can, that's not what they would see as the ideal. And her conclusion was, there's this remarkable intertwining of mothering and fathering that's necessary for children. I wanted to just end with some of these conclusions and show you what the other key factor in motherhood is, which is that relationship with her husband. We've talked about how a wife married to a man helps him with his fathering. But you could say the same about mothers. They're influenced in other ways with being connected to the husband, the father of those children. So here's our conclusion. There's a belief in a deep-seated difference in caregiving styles. Mothers seem to have a greater propensity for emotional connection. They do some kind of emotion work that's unique. But individuals and couples who move back and forth in their views as to who is more nurturing, in which context and at which times. In other words, fathers seem to do a certain kind of nurturing at particular times in that child's development that's essential that mother cannot do. And it's rooted in the ages of children. When children are young, it looks different than as children age. I remember reading, David, I think this is in your book, Fatherless America, but there was this funny quote where he says, for the people who advocate for this sort of ideal of mothers being, fathers being more like mothers and men looking more like women, they envision a chronic world of babies in diapers. It's something like that. In other words, if men would just get their act together and change half the diapers, life would be better. But what they weren't envisioning is that future where children don't need diapers changed. They need help getting a job and getting into universities and interfacing with the world outside them. They need a dad. They need a man. And so when we talk about measuring emotion work and how mothers take care of children, so often we leave outside the picture what that remarkable contribution is of men and how essential it is for their development. We haven't measured it. Okay, so do mothers need husbands? Do they need fathers? Well, more and more we get this image of you seen in the hookup culture dialogue. Dr. Rhodes talked about what happens to women when they experience that hookup culture. It's devastating. Emotionally, physically, it's devastating for them. Well, do you think that ends in college? So what we find out is mothers who are in chronically repeating relationships, they have little children and there's a guy moving in and a guy moving out, another guy moving in, another guy moving out. Do you think it affects their parenting? Well, we know maternal sensitivity is really strongly related to marital status. Mothers who are being cared for by a loving husband are in a much better place to give the kind of maternal sensitivity that children desperately need. Maternal stress and the quality of mothering is really strongly related to mother's relationship changes. So how she's experiencing her own romantic relationships is spilling over into how she does parenting. It's also related to financial security. I've also done research on this gap between what women want to be doing in terms of work and what they're actually doing. And there's a big gap, just like was talked about this morning with Dr. Rhodes, that my study showed 40% of women, 42% were working full-time, 40 hours a week, and only 15% actually preferred that. They were asked, what do you prefer? What are you actually doing? Only 15% wanted that. There were a lot who wanted part-time employment. They want opportunities. They do not want to be responsible for all of that money-making that's necessary for nurturing. Why? Because they're worried about the everyday caregiving of that child. And so the best thing that a man can do, his great work, is to endow motherhood, if you will. It is to enable her to do her motherhood so well. He protects that mother, and she protects the children. And he also does what I've shown. He also nurtures those children in his own unique ways. He's key in enabling her to nurture in the way that she can best nurture. That's why that traditional structure really works. She's cared for, and the children can be cared for by her because she is cared for. And just so you know, one of the things that will happen is people become very critical of marriage as being patriarchal and dangerous for women. But there's just a hands down, all the evidence shows, where do you think women are safest? Cohabitation, being single with a boyfriend coming in periodically, or marriage? Hands down, it's marriage. So we know that poverty increases dramatically outside of marriage. You've already been aware of those studies. But a never married mother, these are kind of old studies, but the same thing, it's evident all over now still. Divorce, marriage versus marriage intact, where is the highest level of poverty? And child abuse, much higher outside of those relationships. And wife abuse outside of marriage is much more likely. The safest place for a mother and her children is within the bonds of marriage, because that's how she can nurture life best, protect life, is within the caregiving of a committed father and husband. Okay, well, let's do questions. And bless you for staying awake all afternoon, fading in and out occasionally.
Thank you.
And I'll just kind of field the questions, but she'll help us get the microphone. So do you have any thoughts or reactions? Yeah.
When you were talking about maternal sensitivity, is there a difference between the biological mother and, say, a mother who adopted the child at birth?
Great question. With lesbian mothers, you know what's interesting? The mother who gave birth to that child, in the case that a mother actually gives birth, she's more connected to that child. But, as you know from having adopted children, Mrs. Wilcox, there's a beautiful development of a bond that happens. And mothers who are sensitive in those interactions can be just as sensitive, right? But it is interesting, in a lesbian relationship, people can observe differences in the way they interact, the one who gave birth versus the one who didn't. There are biological factors there. Do you have any thoughts to add on that?
Yes. The bond would be the same, there'd be no preferential treatment. You know, for the child, just as you would have a child who was born of two biological parents would receive the same type of treatment.
Isn't that beautiful? So one of the difficulties is when there's a difference, is what you're highlighting. So if they're both...
Right. So I could see in a lesbian relationship where there's one woman has a biological tie to the child and the other does not, that this disparity causes some problems. Mm-hmm. But in heterosexual couples where there's either both have no biological tie or both have a biological tie, there doesn't seem to be a difference
in the
bonding with the child.
Yeah, thank you. Does that help answer that? Good. Thank you so much, Mrs. Wilcox. Other thoughts, even reactions? Yeah, right over here.
Just something I'd kind of like a little clarification on.
Yeah.
To play devil's advocate, you in part of your argument had, well, men take this role of kind of making them more independent, where it's more make your own sandwich, et cetera, et cetera, mm-hmm. and so forth. and then moving them out into the world a little bit. It seems to me that it's interesting to argue that it seems you're making a role out of a non-role. Does that make sense? And that if you're gonna make a role out of a non-role, then I mean you can't. If you have that it's not a problem if you don't have a non-role, or it's not as big a problem. In other words, you said that with the sandwich example, you know, if the kid asks the dad to make him a sandwich, and he says go make your own sandwich, well that's one thing. If the kid doesn't have a dad to ask to make a sandwich, then the kid still doesn't get a sandwich made for him, basically. Does that make sense? Could you clarify that a little bit?
So, in other words, that role is possible because the child's going to get a sandwich as it is. I don't know if I understand. I'm sorry. Is
refuse the child's request?
So the father acted in a capacity to in his capacity to refuse the child's request. In that way, he was absent. You could argue.
Right. Well, she was right. That's what she was kind of saying. At first, when she looked at it, she was like, "Okay, here's the absent dad pulling out of fatherhood." So
that might be what Martin's referring to as the non-role. Is that correct, Martin?
Okay. 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 Yes. So the children were eating, right? I think what she noted is where some people could argue that, okay, there's this dad is just, he's going off to play computer games while his child eats lunch or whatever, or makes their own lunch. But she was just inviting another perspective by saying, we could see this as he's pulling out, or what I came to see it myself as, she's saying, as this is a way of nurturing that's integral. This child learning how to make their own sandwich is important, and it's like the father could get a vision of that. That was different than the mother. Is that helping at all? Okay. Okay. Yeah, Dr. Rhodes.
Are there any studies about when lesbians have to decide about work family? Do they argue about who's going to get to go to work or who's going to get to stay home more with the baby?
I'm sure. That happens. I haven't seen studies that looked specifically at that decision-making process, but there is so much evidence about this difficulty between who's biologically connected to the child and who's not. There's some evidence that way, and so I would probably that is an issue. One thing you should know right off, and Dr. Wilcox is really good at presenting this, is that lesbian relationships are very unstable. Even when there's a child involved. So as they're promoting these findings, saying, see, look, this is good mothering going on, except half of them broke up within 5 years. Half of the couples. And these are committed lesbian mother. I mean, this is people selected into this group. They wanted to demonstrate their good mothering, that kind of thing. And half of them broke up within 5 years. So that's a problem. That's a problem in terms of children's well-being, because we know this whole in and out of connecting who you're bonded to is dangerous for them. Now, I've heard Dr. Wilcox talk about how it's almost like even in countries where there's a lot of support for lesbian marriages, where marriage is legal and all of that, and these couples break up, they even found they lasted around 18 months. I mean, it was a brief period. It was like they got bored with each other. You're too much the same. I'm sick of talking about all of this stuff. I don't know, but... But there's something about the dynamic that doesn't keep unity. And one of the beautiful things about heterosexual marriage is its permanence. There's something about the differences between men and women, and when they are committed to each other, committed to the institution of marriage, that brings permanence. And if there's something children need, guess what it is? Permanence. That's critical. That's key to their development. That's what attachment research is showing us. They need permanence. They need to know somebody's there to care for them, and somebody who should be caring for them is there. Yeah.
So I know that you're from a big family, and I myself would love to have a big family someday, but you sometimes hear people arguing that, you know, looking down on big families and saying, oh my goodness, like a mother couldn't possibly adequately care for all of those children. How would you respond to that? And do you have any studies or information about mothering large numbers of children?
Yeah, okay. We've had lots of conversations, Katie, about this in our family. Or Catherine is a cat. Okay. And whether or not this is true, can mothers and fathers care for more than a small group of children? And I can just tell you, I have a sister who's 16 months younger than I am. We were number five and number six. And when my mom conceived the sixth one, she was like, oh, this is nuts. I cannot do this. After Ellen was born, she said there was a friend there watching, and she just said, I'm sure this child is not getting enough of my attention. And this visitor looked over at Ellen, and she was surrounded by her five older siblings who were giving her a tremendous amount of attention, more than she wanted. And one of the things that I think is marvelous about families is that there's all this nurturing that happens from that mother and father as well as from all the other children. Now, Mike, my husband, would say one of the greatest things you can do is give your child a sibling. Give your child a sibling. Give them two siblings. Give them five siblings, because they know the history of that child. They share that world in a unique way. The longest lasting relationship in the history of relationships is the sibling relationship. You're with those people from beginning to end. Dr. Rhodes is reconnecting probably with your siblings in a neat way. That happens. And siblings are a powerful influence on one another. And so while fathers and mothers are obviously key, we cannot undervalue the influence of the family dynamic in nurturing one another as a family. And maybe you would have, Danielle, some other thoughts, having eight children. Just, I'm sure you've thought about that yourself.
Yeah, I don't have anything really more to add, just that you've kind of summed it up. If it weren't for my older children, you know, we have 60-month-old twins, and we're expecting another one, which on paper looks absolutely insane, but it is all the older children who do so much great loving and nurturing of these little twins and of it taking care, and there are lots of little partnerships within the family. I feel like they're also learning how to be good friends to one another, which then will help them hopefully to be good friends to people outside the family.
Yeah.
But it's really been great.
Thank you. I think Mike, my husband, would also add, there's a tremendous amount of pressure on one child to be everything to their parents, right? I mean, it's very interesting how that wonderful gift of sharing this care for your parents and being cared for by your parents is a gift. Do you want to add anything? I loved that. No? Okay. Great question, Catherine.
I was wondering whether you could speak to the effect of the image of women upon mothering, and I refer specifically to the image of beauty that we're often given, which is a sexualized woman in her 20s who is definitely not looking like a mother, definitely not pregnant, and definitely not 40 years old with several children.
Yeah.
And whether there have been any studies on that, or if you have personal reactions.
Great question. I love to get students to think about the damage of the sexualization of women. It is profound. I mean, we know it psychologically has been devastating to women. When I say sexualization, I mean women being viewed as sexual objects. I've heard some people say that we see an average of 3,000 advertisements a day, and I'm guessing with Facebook and other things, you see way more than that. And that in almost, well, I've heard different estimates, you could say 80 to 90% of them, women are shown as sexual objects, whether they're the shape of the bottle or their back is shown at some restaurant. I mean, just bizarre things. People find a way of putting a woman's body in there, and she's used as a sexual object. And not only do they not have, you know, blemishes, they don't even have pores. It's hardly, like you're saying, the kind of body that bears and nurtures life. And so in thinking of what you do on college campuses, and just in your own minds and hearts, how do you measure what is done in the work of nurturing life, the physical work of nurturing life? That creates bonds between a mother and a child that are immeasurable. I think about, you know, how people will talk about their mother. I've heard people say, my mom is like the sun, and she's always there. Or different ways of metaphorizing the influence of mother. That is because of hundreds of thousands of tiny acts of physical nurturing. That's wiping noses. That's giving drinks to. That's changing diapers. That's all the hundreds of thousands of things that do. That work is so undervalued, right? I mean, it's like, are you kidding? So don't ever look like you've actually done it. And I want you to just know that is the great work of life. Jean Elshtain, when she talks about the feminist movement, she makes this great statement where she says, women, what happened is we turned on the feminine values that had been sustained and had sustained moral virtue for generations. And then she says this. This is the feminist movement. Behold the new woman as the old man. There was nothing new about it. This is the old man. This is the devaluing of the nurturing kind of work of life. This is that sustains life. It's the devaluing of anything that was not career movement. It's the devaluing of political or anything that was not politically involved, right? She's saying, we've got to, if we're going to be true to our womanhood, we must sustain the values that womanhood represented. Selflessness, care, the kind of nurturing work that nurtures life, and involve men in it. They need it too. It saves us both. Yeah, I hope that helps, but I do. I get aghast myself at that.
Q&A session now. So can everyone join me in giving her another round of applause?
And if you guys want to move forward and in, you're welcome to. You're fine where you're at as well. But okay, I would like to open our final panel, which is a Q&A panel called Shaping Campus Life, How to Engage in Conversations with Peers. And I will be moderating this panel, which is a neat opportunity because I have been, I guess in representing Love and Fidelity, I have been touched by the questions and the comments that have been made today. It's evident, your convictions are evident, the way that you think through these questions and the way that you listen to the speakers shows great insight and wisdom and passion for these things. And our mission at the Love and Fidelity Network is to train, equip, and educate you with the arguments, resources, and direction you need to uphold the institution of marriage between a man and a woman, the unique role of the family, and the integrity of sex and human relationships. And so in light of that, a lot of the questions that you have asked have been personal, and they've, I think, been answered quite well. And there's probably more answers to gain from that. When the Wilcoxes were speaking, there was a point that they made that I think applies well to perhaps this panel, in that they said, a man and a woman should find the unique talents that they have, bring those. So it didn't have to be 50-50, but it needed to be equitable. And I think in terms of the questions that you've asked, that there, we could approach it the same way, that in our communities, we can bring the talents that we have and use them to make the proper arguments, to find the right direction and resources. And so as you think about questions that you have from the content today and about the differences between the sexes and the complementarity between them, I would just encourage you to think in terms of initiatives on your campus, to think about practical questions, messaging, like how you would phrase things or ask these speakers. They are scholars, and they do this sort of thing, and they respond to it both in the classroom and in the literature. And so ask them ways that you can respond in a newspaper column or in a conversation in a dorm. Ask them, you know, how to respond to opposition, both when it's posed to you as well as when you just you sense what it is in a broader way. And with that direction, we'll open it up for questions. I don't think we have a runner. Could we get that? Okay. You do. And I'm gonna still listen. Wonderful.
All right, questions.